part two, maybe of question mark. I don't know. I'm going to say this will be our second trilogy. We are speaking with a former college basketball player, Mark Sonnen of the Northern Iowa Panthers, who is us. Well, he's Montana Samuels, having a tough time with that name today. I don't know what it is. Oh. And I am Mike Bonner. No problems with that name. I don't know what it is. Montana Samuels is...
Yeah, I don't know what's going on today, Mike.
Tongue-tying me today.
You got something... you got to get off your chest or something?
No, I mean, I don't think so. He's clearly concerned. Can't get it off my chest. That's the problem.
He's concerned with the pick he just made because our brackets have done so poorly.
Oh, that's such a sad...
Oh, but I think everyone was
steering
in the same
into your
boat.
Bracket.
Yeah, I know.
What did I say before the tournament? I don't care about your bracket.
Well, that's true. Yeah, yeah. So this podcast is going to be dedicated entirely to talking about brackets.
And I'll be leaving. Now, we have Mark Sonnen in where we spoke last week about the business of college basketball, and he's a former college basketball player who played professionally in Europe as well. Mm-hmm. And I think he provides a really interesting perspective. When speaking with him, he talked about you don't realize how much of a business it actually is until the NCAA tournament. So mm-hmm. I think it's a perfect time to bring him in. And in my mind, we can't help but have a final part of this trilogy as the national championship game
sure.
next week.
And I think one thing to add before we get into Mark's interview, his experience of sort of realizing the business of NCAA basketball quickly was amplified by the fact he went to a really small school, and then they immediately pulled off a major upset.
Who did they beat?
They beat Kansas. That was the end of the podcast.
Well, if you're going to drive us into your bracket, I'm going to drive you back into Ali Farouk Manesh.
Who was brought up within like 2 minutes of the interview. It just happened.
It was great.
Notice
Montana, which I got that correct that time. It's a big Kansas fan, so I was actually thinking our podcast could be a live
Well, you know
pod.
What? This is so since this is happening, this will air today. We're going to edit and post this today. Shout out to my guy Malik Newman, putting up 32 points yesterday. You know what? You know what? Next week's pod. You know what? I'll save that for the outro. We'll save it for the outro.
I forgot. Yeah, I'm actually really happy to see Malik Newman go to the championship game. His road has been long and interesting. It's difficult to say. It was difficult. I'm sure it was, but as being a five-star athlete prospect,
sure.
You could definitely have a more difficult journey. But I think he deserves it. Hard work kind of paid off for him, and I'm happy to see him happy in a place at Kansas, which I thought he probably maybe should have gone in the first place. But, hey, it's each person's
school,
journey.
Right? Yeah.
So,
well, you know what? I'm good to see Malik Newman happy as well in the Final Four. Massachusetts Street was going off last night. It was beautiful to see.
Montana's a little too high, so we're going to go into Mark's interview and bring
high,
up that.
High on a victory, not
and,
at
and
work.
We're going to go. We're going to lower him down a little bit and bring up Kansas and you and I from more than a couple years ago. But here's Mark Sonnen. Well, as promised, we have Mark Sonnen here with us, former University of Northern Iowa basketball player and played in Germany overseas for a couple years as well. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
So we talked last week about the business of college basketball. So I'm curious, from your perspective, how did you view the business of the college game, maybe in high school as you were recruited, and then how do you see it now?
You know, in high school, you don't really look at it sometimes as a business because of how young you are. You have that dream of going to play college ball, and all you kind of see it for at first is sport, which is what you fall in love with, and it's not until you kind of get there and you kind of go through it where you kind of see more of the business side of college basketball. And there's still great parts to it, but you start to see, you know, coaches changing jobs, things like that, and the money that's involved, especially when you start to get into the NCAA tournament and things like that, and you start to realize a little bit different side of it. That you didn't always see as a high school kid and somebody getting recruited, because you were so focused on, you know, school and basketball, and those were the two main things as a kid. You're looking at the schools. And so until I got there and kind of went through it all, I started to see the money that was going in the NCAA tournament, and, you know, depending on how teams won and the money involved. It was kind of an eye opener for me, especially, and you know, other players too that I've talked to lately since I've gotten done. And that's where I think, you know, the last couple weeks, stuff has come out with stuff. I think it's been starting to get bigger and bigger, and more other people are starting to look at it more.
You talked about the NCAA tournament specifically, and you played in the NCAA tournament your freshman year and played against and beat one of the Final Four teams now, Kansas, you know, a big blue blood type of program. When was that moment for you that it kind of clicked? Was it as early as freshman year in that NCAA tournament when you knew that, I mean, you look at all of the billions going in for the NCAA tournament. When was that moment for you that the light clicked and said, wow, there's a lot of money being generated here in college basketball?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, my freshman year was the best year that we had as far as my career at UNI. And you'd start to realize, you know, when you win more and more, how things kind of change as far as, you know, getting, you know, the stuff, you know, from Nike endorsements and things like that. When you go to the tournament, you're getting stuff. And then you start to see the money part as far as, you know, I know every time you think you win in each round, your school gets money or the conference gets money. And, you know, you start going out to eat. Things are a little different when you go out to eat, how nice a place you're going. And it's kind of, it's an eye opener in the tournament because you also see how many people are there and how many people watch the tournament and how many people started to know who UNI was after that some more. And it was just a big eye opener for me, just my freshman year, to see that.
And do you, so we look at it this year and Loyola has sort of occupied a similar space that UNI did in that tournament. What do you think, I'm not sure how familiar you were with that program prior, but what do you think a smaller school like Loyola is now going to be going through now that they made a Final Four and things like that? Will those changes, do you think, come with them, or does it differ with program to program?
You know, I would probably say it's maybe different with programs, but I would say with what they're going through, that's an amazing run, and I think it's going to be a big change with their school. And, you know, another thing I didn't mention was just the coverage your school gets and how much your enrollment changes. And I know ours spiked quite a bit after our run, and I could only imagine, you know, Loyola's getting to the Final Four as a school like that with, you know, a lot of good upperclassmen guys and great players. I think that can bring a lot of people into their school now, you know, from the Chicago area and even people kind of outside of the Illinois area, Chicago area, to come in and go to school there. And so that's a lot of money now going into their school from just the coverage they've received.
Right. And so that sort of brings up an interesting point, because obviously basketball brings in a substantial amount of money to these schools, but as does enrollment. You see an increased endowment with things like that, and especially Loyola being in Chicago, it seems like a perfect place for kids to want to go to school. As a player at UNI, did you notice those trends while you were there? And what was the general feeling of the team and knowing that you as players were sort of responsible for that boom?
I don't know if you sometimes always notice it in the moment. Sometimes it's maybe a little bit after the moment that you kind of notice it as a player. But it is something that you do realize, kind of the impact you have. And, you know, every player is different. Every school is different, because obviously you look at the Kentuckys and the North Carolinas, and obviously those players, those high player profiles, they're, I mean, those are the guys a lot of times that are bringing a lot of the money. And so sometimes it's a smaller school or, you know, even smaller player, you might not see it as much until that tournament hits. And that's where you start to see it a lot more, those smaller schools or those small names nobody ever heard about. I mean, look at a guy like Ali on my team, you know, hitting that shot. I couldn't tell you how many people have come up to me if I have a UNI shirt on. They're like trying to say his name and they can't. And they're asking me about him. And, you know, nobody would have maybe, and it's nothing against him, but nobody might have not even known about him before that tournament. But what he did in there, it kind of put his name on there and the school on there on the map. And I think it could do that for a lot of small schools. That bigger schools just naturally have that. They have the coverage and they have the cachet that a lot of the big players have. So I think it helps a lot of smaller schools kind of get their name out there and players get their name out there.
Two things that kind of came to my mind when you were talking about, you know, the business aspect of it, and we were speaking about Loyola, which currently plays in the same conference that Mark did, the Missouri Valley, but you talk about the business of it. Mark never played against Loyola in the Missouri Valley. They didn't join until 2013 because of conference right. realignment. Another aspect of the business, I know I went to Syracuse University, and when they went to the ACC, the chancellor said, well, we're doing it because of, I think they want to renew the rivalry with Boston College. And it was just, if you're going to talk, that's a joke, you know,
yep.
If you're going to move for money, just say that. From your perspective, how do you view conference realignment, especially, you know, with the Creightons and the Wichita States no longer in the Missouri Valley, which really created that great basketball culture there, and it continues now with Loyola, but it's different, much like the Big East now is different with Villanova and Xavier still got number ones, but it's not that Syracuse, Georgetown, Pittsburgh, you know, Louisville. Yeah. Well, I guess Louisville wasn't even original, but yeah, how do you view that as a player who lived and probably loved those rivalries, and now it just maybe doesn't have that feel?
Oh yeah, no, actually it was funny because I was talking about it with my buddy about how much, you know, just those two teams, you know, leaving the conference and the other teams coming in, and you don't sometimes know about the other teams coming in, how good they're going to be and what they're going to bring to your conference. I mean, it kind of, at first, was kind of one of those to me when I looked at it. It was, man, that would kind of suck if it wasn't Wichita in there or Creighton in there. Because those were really good teams, not only to go and play at, but also when they came into our place. And it brought a lot of fans, which is you know, more money and things like that for the university. And so I felt like at first it was one of those where it kind of hurt our conference. But now I feel like the teams, you know, that have come in have done a great job. And I think it's starting to hopefully build and maybe make our conference even better and allow these teams that maybe didn't have it in another conference to get a better chance now. But I'm not always a big fan of the realignment. I feel like it can hurt some teams that are still left in that conference, you know, of maybe having two or three teams getting into the tournament, where now sometimes our conference maybe is looked at a one team, you know, that can get in. I mean, look at Loyola. They didn't hit that shot in the conference tournament. They wouldn't even be in the NCAA tournament probably.
I always hear this argument when it's brought on, and when we're talking about conference realignment, it's specifically business oriented. There's no other reason to do it other than a business financial measure, and then the players aren't receiving financial measures, at least in the mid majors. The Power Five approved a rule to kind of have a cost of living expense, so to speak. But
yep.
I'm curious, one of the arguments I always hear, and when I'm talking to people who say, you know, amateurism and players should not be paid and things like that for their services, is, and Montana brought this up in the last podcast, the jerseys, you know, the jersey numbers.
Oh, yes.
You're wearing a specific jersey, and everyone knows what number it is. And then I hear some people say, well, it's just an honor for that player. They'd rather just see the player jersey out there than get any compensation. So I'm curious from your aspect, when you see someone wearing, you know, the college jersey, everyone knows what number it actually is and what team it is. What kind of goes through your mind?
Oh, it's funny. I mean, I see it when I go back down, and you'll see it at stores, and they never just pick the most random number. I mean, no guy just comes out and says, all right, let's put 43 on there, or 42, right. or 20, 25. And it's always going to be the best player on the team because they know what sells. And they know that the players sell the jerseys because nobody's going to go to the game to watch the coach. Nobody's going to go to the game to watch anything else but the players play the game. And so you see that, and I know they don't put the names on there, but no matter what, any kid can look at that and think, I know exactly who that is without the name on the back just because of the number. And so it's kind of, you know, it's one of those where I just seen a case with something about a guy with a YouTube, and he can't promote his name on YouTube and receive money, but the NCAA can take his number and use that to make money off of.
Right. And so we sort of, in talking about the financial side of college basketball, we inevitably get to the argument of how do we reciprocate the players. And we've seen this through Nigel Hayes at Wisconsin last year was really vocal about it. Jay Billis has been vocal for the last few years, probably for the last like 5 years, I would imagine. When you see people like that stepping up, not so much Jay Billis, as he's sort of someone who's been through it and is now an ESPN personality, but when you see guys like Nigel Hayes who are sort of putting their name out there as players, how do you view that? Does that make you, is that like a powerful statement to you? Do you think it has an impact on the people at large?
Oh yeah, I believe so. And I think it takes, you know, it can't just be, and no offense, it'd be like me. I couldn't just, when I was playing, just kind of come out and say it. It has to be a I mean, it has to be a player that's more of a high profile player, mm-hmm. and things like that for a lot of people sometimes to listen because they have the platform sometimes with social media, followers, things like that. And they have the power to kind of get their message out more than kind of just the average college player. And so I think it would take more of those type of guys to really make a change. But it's really cool to see guys that kind of aren't afraid to come out and say that, because a lot of kids, you know, they're afraid maybe to say something because, you know, your scholarship's only 1 year. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're guaranteed 4 years. I mean, it's just like you watch the guys in the NFL. Some of them are scared to say some things because of what their contract can happen. So I feel like some college athletes might not speak up because of this might be their only shot. They don't want to mess it up. But other guys know that, you know, they may have a chance after college. And so they know they can put their name out there a little bit more and what they want to say. So it's kind of cool to see guys like that kind of step up and say something.
Yeah, you bring up a good point because we were talking about how, and we didn't bring this up last week, but how the system almost empowers the powerful because, as you said, it's a 1 year scholarship, and there's really no value in for someone to speak up other than, you know, trying to speak what they believe in. How does that culture perpetuate, as you said, the one scholarship year where, you know, coaches have this, you know, at least 4 years usually, and then they can leave whenever they want, and then we've seen players not be able to transfer where they want to go. How does the culture of college athletics kind of perpetuate the aspect that you just kind of mentioned, that it's difficult to speak out and maybe say, hey, we deserve some compensation?
Oh yeah, no, and especially as most, you know, when I was in college, you're not as fully matured yet to deal with some mm-hmm. of that stuff. And so sometimes you're an 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid, and you're trying to deal with all this, and other people are telling you things on what to do, and you're trying to make decisions. And it's not always easy when, you know, somebody could literally take your scholarship too for no reason sometimes. And if they want to get another player to come in instead of you and they don't have a scholarship available, they can take it if they want to, no matter what. And so it's kind of one of those where the coach gets fired, and what does the coaches get? They're going to get some type of money and payout if they end up getting fired a lot of times in their contract. But if a player gets let go, it's not like still gets a scholarship for the rest of the 4 years, and, you know, even if he wants to finish school. So I feel like if it's really a student athlete, that we need to somehow look out for the kid as far as the schooling part, because if he just gets let go and he can't go back to school or get into school, then kind of hurts him to finish it if he can't afford it. So I feel like there has to be some type of allowance in order to, you know, I don't like transferring, and I think it's hurting sometimes college basketball how many people do transfer. Mm-hmm. But it's just like any business. If you don't like your job and you want to leave your job, I mean, you have availability. But for us as players, you don't. As a coach, you can. Mm-hmm. So that's why I feel like there's nothing that's the same as far as players being able to have the freedom to do what they like.
Do you think the one-and-done rule has almost amplified that lack of freedom? Because you have these guys who are, when you were speaking earlier about like guys like Nigel Hayes or someone with a bigger name could really make a difference in speaking out against players not being reciprocated for what they're bringing to universities, it kind of brought up a point in my mind where I think possibly it could be more difficult now to do that because it takes so much time to build up a sort of a fandom for a specific player.
Oh, yes.
Like Marvin Bagley, I'm sure Duke fans really, really love him. But like, for instance, he doesn't have that type of relationship with the fan base that Frank Mason or Devontae Graham had at Kansas.
Or Grayson Allen currently
Grayson
has.
Grayson Allen at Duke, right? So because
his
they've
teammate.
Been there for 4 years. Do you think
it takes
that's,
that time?
Yeah, right. So do you think that's almost going to be more difficult moving forward to sort of see players empower other players because the players of that stature who are sort of the big names on campus are now just there for a year more times than not?
Oh, yeah. And a lot of times, you know, the general fan that sees not even a fan, but just a general person that just sees a kid going to college for mm-hmm. 1 year and then going to the NBA, they're not always going to, I feel like, take his word and what he says to be the best, because they're looking at him like, oh, you just want to go to the NBA. You're not really for this. And so I feel like some people won't even listen to him a lot. So it will take those 3-4 year guys that, you know, have a bigger growth in their community and in their schools to have that. But there's not always a lot of those, like not a lot of Frank Masons out there and mm-hmm. guys like that that stay that long and have that cachet from all their fans and everything like that.
We've talked about it a lot. I'm curious from your perspective, do you believe that players should receive some type of compensation?
You know, I think it's tough because I'm not 100%. You just got to pay all these guys because I feel like the money is going to keep, you know, if we could start getting paid, then how much money is going to get paid? But I feel like there's got to be some type mm-hmm. of way. I thought of something as far as it's tough, but like something, you know, if you went to school, you graduated, you had some type of money after that can help you out maybe to get a place or start your life out after college. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, you know, instead of $5,000 a year you get every year, maybe that goes into a fund that you can receive after. Or because I feel like sometimes you might spend a lot of that money on stuff, you know, maybe you shouldn't as an 18 year old, because in high school you're not taught always how to manage your money and things like that, so you get all that money up front and I don't know if it's always going to be there when you really need it. And so I don't know if there's a way, but I think they got to find a way as far as compensating it. Because I know if I work for a business and that business would bring in $900 million right. in three weeks, right. I'd probably be like, well, what's going on with that? So that'd be the only thing I would say.
Right. And it's interesting, too, because it's not only it's weird because I asked you because how do you balance out the Kentuckys and the Kansases of the world that have so much money, but really yep. when you look at this tournament, everyone's talking about the Loyolas. You know, when you talk about right. you're walking down the street with a UNI shirt, everyone's talking about Ali Farouk Manesh. Like that's the that's the person that makes the tournaments, right. so to speak, is the little guys.
Yes.
So it's really interesting of how you balance the haves and then the have-nots.
Right.
Yep. No, that is very true. And one point I forgot to mention is, you know, with what you receive and things like that on scholarship, a kid that has a good family and things like that and can afford, you know, extra stuff, you're not going to really maybe have a big issue on college. If you come from a family that can't afford a lot and things like that, and that is a lot in college basketball, you're struggling in college. I'll say that. I know a lot of guys that didn't come from a whole lot. And what you receive as far as your scholarship, to what you have to pay for with your room and board and things like that, a lot of kids aren't going to be able to do anything. I mean, they can't afford anything extra, even to maybe go to a movie with a girl and things like that. That might not seem like they should be able to do that, but just doing any day things, if you don't have the money extra outside of what you get for a scholarship, you can't do anything extra. So that's the one thing I don't get about how much money you really do get for your scholarship.
And I think the other aspect, too, that people don't quite understand, that don't know the ins and outs, is it sounds a lot like other college students, but other college students can get jobs where student athletes really can't, because A, either they're using their likeness, or B, there's just no time for it.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't. I mean, the only time you could really get a job is during the summer, but usually you're working the camps as your job. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's no – because you're usually – I mean, my typical day – during the season or during just any time would be like, I'd wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning and I would get back home at about 10 at night. So it's not like you much, yeah. I mean, your school right. basketball pretty much the whole day. And that's more than a 40-hour job.
Right.
So if you look at it like that, now you do have other times that you're free and things like that. You have freedom sometimes, but you just don't have a lot of extra time to do anything like that.
Right. And so I'm always curious, because the argument people often go to immediately is sort of a knee-jerk reaction when they're opposed to the notion of paying players or something like that, is, well, they're already being paid because they're on scholarship. I think it would be I think it'd be really informative for people to sort of hear from you what, because I think for people who sort of have an idea of what's really going on with a college athlete's schedule, much like being able to get a job as a college athlete versus a normal college student, the amount of classroom time that you actually have as a college athlete is not the same as a person who's maybe on an academic scholarship or something like that. Can you sort of explain how much classroom time actually plays into that daily schedule that you just brought up?
Yeah. So like, I mean, we, like you say, a typical day, you know, sometimes depending on what semester it is, you're taking maybe a more loaded course with classes, like more during the season. You're probably not going to take 18 credits, things like that. But my and your times are different. So you have to get your times in your classes in certain hours. So you can't just be like a regular student, like whatever works happens. I mean, you have to usually get your classes in between 8 a.m. and sometimes noon, sometimes 1, sometimes 2, depending on when your practice is. Then maybe you have to take a night class if you can't get your classes in. But usually, like say a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I would usually have about 3 or 4 hours of class time, and then you'd have study hall usually mandatory, and then you'd obviously have your studies after, going to the library. And then like a Tuesday, Thursday, you might have maybe 2 or 3 or 4 hours of class, same thing, study hall mandatory, and then you're doing your studies after. But if I looked at like a typical day, you'd do, like I'd wake up at 5 o'clock, work out, and then do a little bit of lifting, then go to class at like 8 to 12, get some lunch. We'd usually have practice maybe or lifting. Then we'd have a workout. Then we'd have study hall. And then I'd probably go and study. And then I'd be back home at like 10. So it's pretty long day, but you get used to it. I think that's what helps athletes is being on a routine. I mean, it's nice to be on a routine and kind of not have one. I think that helps athletes a lot.
And is that schedule the same when you're in season as well? So that includes like travel and games and things of that nature?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it changes. Your out of season, kind of your preseason, things like that are sometimes longer days because in the season you're not always doing all the extra lifting, all the extra stuff, but you're still getting up shots. I mean, you're still traveling. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times we get back at – heck, I remember when we got back after the NCAA tournament. I think it was after the Kansas game. I think we got back at like – 5 o'clock in the morning, you get a class at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're going to class. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, most people, they get back at 5 a.m. and if you're an average student, there's class at 8 a.m. It's probably going to be a nice sleep-in day. But I mean, he made sure that you showed up, and that was probably not a bad thing to go to school that day. It really wasn't school that much. It was like more of an enjoyment day, you could say. A lot of students really weren't caring about it, but it was still good to go. And he, Coach Jake, made sure that, you know, he always made sure that you did show up and things like that. And I think that's really good because when you get done with sports, kind of helps in your job life and things like that.
It's a perfect segue into kind of the next stage that I want to ask you about, specifically playing in Europe. Before we get into actually playing, Monte and I were talking last week about the stigma that kind of revolves around players who, specifically a Brennan Jennings type of player, who didn't want to go to college and wanted to play in Europe first. And there's a stigma around that he's not a team player or he didn't follow the process. From your perspective, how do you view players that, you know, maybe don't want to go to college for the one and done and want to go over to Europe? Or I think the Balls just did it as well. Do you think there should be more options, whether it's, you know, LeVar Ball's idea of a league that players can get played to play in, or going over to Europe? Or do you think, to me, it just makes more sense to have more options, but I'm curious from your perspective if the NCAA and the college game, the process that it has now, kind of works.
Oh, no, I think there definitely should be, I think there should be multiple ways.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's just been college for so long, and there's nothing, I mean, there's good and bad things in college and what they do and everything like that, but I feel like there's nothing wrong with going overseas and playing. I mean, it does. I would probably say, to be honest, that would probably get you more ready than college, depending on where you went, because there's some really terrible places overseas too. But if you're obviously a high profile player, you're going to go to some place and you're going to literally learn probably how to be a pro.
Okay.
More than college. I mean, like at college, you're considered an amateur, you're not a pro. So they're not going to teach you how to do that type of stuff. So I think that's totally fine. I don't know, you know, how the LeVar Ball League and things like that will be. But you never know. But I feel like it's just like there's a lot of things that are just so old school where it feels like everybody wants it to be the same way forever. And I feel like that's everything else changes. Technology, everything else changes. Why can't we learn how to change other things?
That's kind of our belief, and I was just curious as a former player from your perspective. And then we're also curious, how does Europe, or I guess it just the rest of the world, how do they view the American college game? We see a lot of, I think Gonzaga had a few European players.
Patty Mills went to St. Mary's, I think.
Right. When you look at some in Europe, I think the players at a younger age can sign to a professional league. What's the opinion of the American college game overseas?
I think it's not not everybody knows about it. It's okay. Not on everybody, but quite a few people do. And I think, at least from the players that I've met that have gone and come over here, a lot of it involves kids that do want to get kind of that education part over here too. Okay. It's not always just about basketball when they come over. I feel like they want to get that, and they want to, I think they want to get that American experience and kind of see what it's like too. But I know there is some people that, even when I was over there, that came up to me, talked to me about the tournament. Now the NBA is very, it's pretty dang big over there, mm-hmm. but I don't think college is as big. I mean, it was funny though, when I was actually over there, there was a girl that was at our gym that was a younger girl, high school girl, I want to say, and Gonzaga actually was over there recruiting her. There was a Gonzaga coach assistant there, and I was like, wow, that's kind of cool to see them over there recruiting. Mm-hmm. And I know Ali, I think when Ali was coaching, I know he was at Drake, I want to say, he was overseas recruiting. So I know some schools do a lot of, mm-hmm. I think it's some schools do it more than other schools. And it might be the connection of players that have played overseas, know coaches over there, and now are coaching here. I think that connection definitely helps with that.
What did you learn playing overseas?
As far as like the game or language,
I guess
culture.
Anything that pops out, you know, you think of your experience over there, what sticks out?
One I would say is, you know, at first I didn't know how they would kind of respond to Americans, mm-hmm. as far as not just Americans that are just watching or looking at their city and tourists and things like that, but somebody actually living there. And there was a lot of people that don't like Americans, or they just don't want to maybe talk. We get that bad reputation, I feel like. But there's also a lot that really, I mean, I'd have fans that would bring me over for dinner and family. I was friends with their family and, you know, worked out their kids. And there's a lot of people that really loved us and they wanted to get to know us and things like that. So it was a very warming experience with a lot of that. The one weird thing was just getting to learn the language. Yeah. It's a different language because everybody kind of sometimes sounds mad, or when they talk to you, it's kind of very deep. and so getting to learn it, I actually did a camp with some kids. And so that helped me kind of learn the language more, because a lot of them didn't, they were really young, so they didn't know English that well. But most of the generation my age and a little bit older all have to take English in high school. So a lot of them are pretty good with English. My teammates were pretty good. The older generation is kind of not as well. But the food was pretty good. It's different, I would say, because I know this is different, but man, like the obesity mm-hmm. from here to there is so much different. I mean, you don't really see a lot of really obese people over there. The food is, I mean, they have McDonald's and stuff, but like their food is very small. Their portions are small. They bike everywhere. I mean, I didn't see much snow. I love that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was weird because I thought I would see snow, and the whole year, my first year, I never even saw a drop of snow. I was like, hey, I see it the whole winter when I'm in Minnesota, so I can't complain. But besides that, I had a really good my team wasn't that great, so that wasn't the easiest thing, kind of being on a bad team. And it is over there. I can totally tell when in the NBA when they talk about, like, culture. Mm-hmm. It's totally the same thing overseas, where the teams that are good are going to be the teams that have a great culture and, you know, can afford and pick the right players and have the right management. Because you do need to have the right people up top that run the team, not just mm-hmm. kind of people that just want to throw the team together and have the money. I mean, you got to be able to have the right people up top, I feel like, to do that. So that was one thing I learned, was kind of sometimes the business part of how you put together a team and seeing how sometimes the teams don't always work. And that was the first time I've been on a team that was kind of a losing team.
Right.
And so I learned actually a lot from it. It wasn't easy, but you don't realize until you get on a team like that why sometimes good teams are good and bad teams are bad.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. And I know you're a basketball trainer now. Kind of give yourself a shout out. Are you? So where can people follow you and go online or something and kind of try to figure it out?
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. So I work for a company called Minnesota School of Basketball. We do a lot of individual training, team training, small group training. A lot of it we focus on is footwork and form. And so it does for a lot of kids at first. They get there and we start just working on your form and your footwork. And a lot of kids don't like that. They want to work on all the moves and the six combo dribbles. And it is tough to really get a kid to buy in. But once you get a kid to buy in, they learn that once you get all that fundamentals down, then you can work on you know, more complex stuff. And so I really work with a lot of younger kids right now, kind of ages from fourth grade to high school. I have a couple college kids, but mostly youth. And it's definitely been a big change for me in learning how to be patient and deal with learning and teaching kids. Because as much as I thought I knew the game, it's a lot different learning how to actually teach it to a kid. Because, you know, you can know how to step with your right foot, dribble, but sometimes a fourth grader doesn't know how to step and dribble at the same time. So you got to be patient with some kids. But it's a really fun job to go to every day. And I've been able to meet a lot of people through it. It's weird because, I don't know, I probably met 10, 15 you and I parents that have brought their kids in. I was like, man, it's crazy to see you're up here living and you went to you and I. So it's a really good experience on teaching and learning how to teach the game instead of just kind of knowing the game.
I had one quick follow-up to that. Have you seen the game evolve in the sense that, I remember when I was growing up, everyone wanted to dunk and, you know, do some high-flying moves, where it seems like now with the emergence of the Warriors, there's much more focus. Hey, I'll shoot a three rather. Have you seen that change at all, or is that just kind of in my head?
Oh, no. That is the biggest. Watch, just go out and go to a park and watch the kid walk into the court, and 90% of the kids, the first shot they're going to take is a three. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to get a kid to understand that at first shooting threes isn't going to make you better as a three-point shooter, because you're just going to change your form and you're just going to push it up there. And so it's getting a kid to understand that, you know, shooting it from 2 feet and being really good from there, and then from 4 feet, 10 feet, 12 feet, and finally the three is actually going to make you a better three-point shooter. And that's why I try to, I mean, with a lot of kids, I don't even go to the three-point line yet. Until they really can shoot it from there, I really try to stay close. And it's a lot of them don't like it. And I think you got to be able to learn how to shoot a three, because it does stretch the floor. And it gives kids, I think, that, I mean, no, not many kids. I mean, I maybe have one kid of mine that I work with that can dunk. So nobody can really watch LeBron go up and dunk and be like, oh, I want to go outside and do that. Right. But you can watch Steph go out there and shoot a three, and you can go outside your driveway and do the same exact thing. And so it gives kids a chance to really maybe kind of give a little more confidence to. I think now sometimes it's overconfidence, but it does give kids a chance to realize that they can do some of the things, at least have a chance to do kind of what Steph can do. Now, nobody will ever do it like him, but at least they can learn how to shoot. Where dunking, it takes you being really athletic or tall to have a chance even.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. This has been a tremendous conversation. I know we've really enjoyed it. We hope you've enjoyed it as well.
So once again, thanks to Mark Sonnen for joining us. Just to reiterate, both Mike and I, in talking, have agreed that we think it is a really interesting. Mike went to Syracuse. I'm from Lawrence, Kansas, so we're familiar with these sort of basketball blue bloods, where everything is in a way about the business as it ties into the product on the floor. But in Mark's case, he sort of had an unjaded perspective of, I didn't realize it until we got to the tournament how big of a deal this was. And he saw people in Farouk Maness jerseys and all of that. So,
yeah, it was really interesting, when especially with everything that comes with the tournament. Like Nike now says, hey, you're doing well, so here's some of the new shoes. And as he said, the per diems maybe perhaps go up for the players.
Yeah,
the meals. Yeah, the nicer hotels, because the NCAA's making you stay at a nice place. So it really kind of adds to perspective. And I think the other aspect, you can't help but think, if you're a player, wow, these stadiums are now packed with double the size of the arenas we usually play
in. Well, I think at that time they were watching, sort of trying out like the football arena, where you got the sunken benches. Those are bad. I haven't noticed any of that. I'm sure the Final Four will be that this year, but I haven't noticed them at any of the smaller, at like the Elite Eight.
I don't think it was like that at any, which sometimes when they do it at Syracuse, it is. It's because they just put it in the middle of the football field.
Yeah, it's no good. I'm sure in San Antonio it'll probably be that, but I would like it to not be. Hot take. NCAA.
I don't think it will be, because what football stadium would be in San Antonio?
I'm sure they have some sort of like convention center that they could do. Maybe not. I don't know.
I'm assuming it'll just be with the Spurs arena.
So this is interesting. They play at the Alamo Dome. Alamo Dome, because that's where they held it in 2008. And you know what happened in 2008, Mike? In San Antonio, the Alamo Dome. Mario Chalmers hits the shot against Memphis. Derrick Rose misses a free throw. University of Kansas, national champions. It was meant to be.
Do you know where I was?
In 2008?
Watching that game, actually.
Where were you?
Toronto.
Really?
Yeah.
were you doing in Toronto?
It was a couple of my college roommates. We went to Toronto to see a Red Sox Blue Jays series, and it was in April.
Did you? You didn't watch the national championship game, or you watched?
I think we did. Yeah, that's. I remember watching it in the hotel room.
Okay, big game for Kansas fans. Shout out to us.
You're trying to end in a high note, right?
Yeah, but we. Yeah. But no. Hold on.
The levels of Montana is like, yes, they're in the championship game. Oh no, I'll leave Farouk Manesh. Oh yes, we're back up in 2008.
It's been a roller coaster, but. Mike, in the intro, I sort of laughed off with the cliffhanger.
You did. I was wondering when we were going to return to.
Fans of the podcast, friends of the podcast, rather, email me at msamuels@hathawaypublishing.com if you would like next week's End of the Trilogy to be a Malik Newman appreciation episode. We've had very preliminary talks about it.
I'm more voting for, and it's going to be interesting because people listening to this will find out what actually happens. I'm voting for an unprecedented live pod. Maybe like a Facebook Live or something where we watch the game with you.
From my apartment and my lucky spot.
Yeah, sure. And I was actually thinking more of like just during a commercial, we check in with you during commercial breaks.
Rather than
like let you enjoy the game, but like a commercial break check-in of, you know, what is Bill Self saying to Kansas?
What is
Montana's mindset right now?
Yesterday it wouldn't have been good, I'll tell you that much. There was a lot of anxiety coming, but Villanova's a good team. Maybe you'll get the anxiety, the anxious shakes.
Did you hear that pathetic like coach speak? Like, Villanova's a good, good team, you know, you just gotta go out there and it's gonna be Kansas Loyola and hey, you know, they're a good team.
Sister Jean, she can really shoot it.
You gotta go out and give 110% in this 5-on-5, and you just gotta go out and dive on loose balls and make the ball bounce your way and see what happens.
Mike said, you can tell Mike used to report sports because anything that sounds like coach speak, he is now immune to.
They're a good team. Who knows? Your voice, you got a pitch there. You were just talking. They're a good team.
I'm preparing, Mike. I'm preparing for all the questions I'll have to answer when Kansas. No, you know what? I'm not even going to say that.
Well, you're preparing actually for a win because we're already talking about a potential.
We should probably hedge our bets into a Final Four championship, a Final Four live pod. You'll have to
tune in next week to see what we do. A lot of it hinges on that Villanova-Kansas game.
Maybe just tune in Saturday. We'll let you know.
It'll be Montana in mourning.
Montana. Well, I mean, not on Saturday. It'll be
on a Monday. Yeah,
Montana pre-morning, and then immediately post-morning after our live Facebook video.
I like the live either way. Like happen. Making you watch the championship game that you don't want to watch because Kansas isn't in it.
Oh God. Okay. Yeah. Sure. I would do that. Yeah. I'd probably do that. All right, Mike. Is there anything else that you want the people to know about how Syracuse did in the tournament, or how Syracuse is looking next year, or how you hate college basketball?
No, I love college basketball.
You gonna fill out a bracket next year?
I don't know. We'll see.
That's a no.
Right. No, we'll see. We'll see. They're a good team. Who knows?
That's a no.
They're a good team.
For Mike Bonner, a lot of good teams. I am Montana Samuels. This has been The Bubble, episode 10.5. And once again, as always, we hope you have a good day.